perhaps never before. And very seldom can you say something like that in a world where there is nothing new under the sun. But perhaps never before has Christianity been the subject of so much scrutiny as it is today. Now, in the early days of Christianity, it was certainly the subject of scrutiny, but it was kind of a ham-fisted scrutiny. Sophisticated objections to Christianity were seldom raised in the early days. The easiest way to deal with Christianity in the earliest days of its existence was simply to put Christians out of everyone else's misery, to persecute or kill. Now, there were questions raised, philosophical questions, and some of them are still with us today. We're going to be dealing in this last part of our series on answering the objections of unbelievers with those very objections themselves. We can't cover all the bases, and if we leave any out, I would welcome anyone to join us during this conversation with Ken Samples with their own objection, either that they've heard or that they'd like us to answer. The skeptic and the unbeliever, welcome to call. 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. Perhaps I should say, maybe never before at this level of intensity and sophistication has Christianity been subject to so much scrutiny and to so much inquiry. Should Christians shy away from answering the objections of unbelievers? Should it be kind of like one of those Jeep commercials? Hey, it's a Jeep thing, and if you're not a Jeep person, you don't get it. Some people get it, some people don't. So the unbeliever and the skeptic should be treated as those who don't get it and are not really worth the time to explain or to answer their inquiries. I think not. Christians need to be always ready to make the defense and give an answer for the hope that is in them. And that means whatever the objection may be, even if it is a specious objection, we need to be ready to give the answer. Does the burden of proof lie on the Christian to show that his faith is well-founded, historic, eventful? No. But Christians ought to, for the sake of the unbelieving world, be willing to bear that burden nonetheless. So we're going to do that here in the last part of our series on answering the objections of unbelievers, thinking through these objections with Ken Samples. Again, feel free to join us, 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Ken Samples is Vice President of Philosophical and Theological Apologetics. Four Reasons to Believe. He's President of the Augustine Fellowship Study Center. And he is author of the book, Without a Doubt, Answering the 20 Toughest Faith Questions. We're going to be talking with him about whether or not all religions lead to the same God. We're going to be talking with him about whether or not science and Christianity are contradictory of one another. What should Christians do with all the world religions out there? Sometimes the objections come from unbelievers who have another religion. And they raise, perhaps not legitimate, but important objections to the Christian faith. When the scientific community says Christians are Luddites, and if you believe the Christian faith, you are abandoning the tenets of science, and you are abandoning all rational thought, how should the Christian respond? When the objection is raised that Christianity is full of hypocrites, does the fact that hypocrites exist, people who don't practice what they preach, within the pale of Christianity, does it invalidate the truth of the Christian faith? I'd be the first to say, yes, there are plenty of hypocrites in Christendom. I would name myself among them. Someone who doesn't always practice what they preach. But does that invalidate the faith itself? We're going to be talking about that with Ken Samples. What about on moral issues? Christians are called upon by the very tenet of their faith to defend the unborn, the helpless, the people who have no defense. And yet the objection is raised in the culture, I have the right to do with my body whatever I want to do with my body. How do you answer that? You can say something like abortion or euthanasia or assisted suicide is wrong, and that may be part of an answer to that objection. But how do you answer the objection's premise that we are our own and that we can do with ourselves as we please? More lately, especially in this postmodern world, the objection is raised by unbelievers and skeptics alike that Christianity, as a matter of history and as a present-day force in the world, promotes intolerance. That the very belief of Christianity at its heart, that there is one Savior, and that one Savior is the one and only way of salvation. And that this one and only way takes a very specific form, not just thinking Jesus was a nice guy, but believing that he is the crucified and risen Savior of all men, the payment made by God for all sin. That very fundamental belief of Christians is counted as intolerant. It is exclusive. One way? Why not many ways? Why not my way or your way, and we're all on the same road? Not to mention the other teachings of Christianity that seem to, at least seem to in the mind of unbelievers and skeptics, sound very, very intolerant. Maybe we need to redefine the word tolerance a bit. Another question we're going to deal with when Ken joins us is about morality itself. Are right and wrong, good and evil, products of our own imagination, our culture, our society, or do they have an objective existence? Is morality, good and evil, simply in the eye of the beholder, so that everyone sees it a little bit different, and it would be wrong of us to judge one another's morality? Christians need to answer that, too. See how fundamental these questions are. And then perhaps the biggest one of all, and this one has been around from the very beginning. How can a good and all-powerful God, if he is what Christians insist he is, loving and merciful and, in essence, good, how can he allow the manifest evil that we find in the world? Some people raise this objection, and they believe that they have found the trump card that wins the pot intellectually and morally over Christianity. The simple existence of evil. Does that disprove a good and all-powerful God? Does that disprove the God that Christianity proclaims? And finally, how should Christians go about preparing themselves to answer all these objections? You can, if you want to, hide from these objections. You can surround yourself with like-minded Christians who never raise any of these objections or any of these questions at all. And you could probably live out your life rather satisfied. There is a principle, however, in Scripture that I find very helpful, not only among Christians, but when Christians deal with the outside world, as we so often wrongly speak of it, the world that we live in. That principle is man sharpens man, like iron sharpens iron. And that applies not only to Christians when they deal with one another, but it applies to Christians when they deal with the objections of an unbelieving world. God has called us to live in the world that he's put us in, and not the world that we would want to live in. It would be great if we could step out, as many of our Christian ancestors were able to do, into a public square where the basic tenets of Christianity were not questioned, where the articles of the faith that Christians hold dear were held equally dear, at least in some sense, by the culture around us, by society, and where the skeptic, if he did exist, kept his hand over his mouth because he probably would have drawn the ire of the entire society if he asked questions. We don't live in that world anymore, folks. We live in a world where the skeptic's questions are often louder and in greater number than the Christian's answers. I think this is why the apostle rightly counsels us to be ready to give an answer. You know what it may come to? It may come to that situation that prevailed in the early church, where there weren't a lot of questions being asked of those early Christians. They simply met the point of the sword. They were ready to give answers. But it may come to that for us too. If not for us, then for our children or our grandchildren. How do we prepare them to give an answer for the hope that we have instilled in them? What you might find out in the course of this conversation with Ken Samples and here in the conclusion of this series is that all of these objections in some way or another touch upon the central pillar of the Christian faith. All of them, whether they be objections about science or whether they be objections about the morality that Christianity puts forth, or whether they be questions from skeptics about any other thing that Christians believe, they all eventually trail back to the cross. When you're dealing with the skeptic who has a simple question, he wants your answer to it, remember, what you are defending in its essence, what you are defending in its essence and always is the central teaching of Christianity. The skeptic may not know it, and you may not be able to draw a direct line between A and B, but what stands at the heart of Christianity and what really is the object of all skepticism from the skeptic and all unbelief from the unbeliever is the cross of Jesus Christ. St. Paul says that there stands at the center of the Christian faith, and without this thing, all of the faith itself is vain, empty, useless, and we are of all men most to be pitied. What stands there is the crucifixion and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. What stands at the center is the person and work of Jesus. Jesus says, if you acknowledge me before men, and he's not talking about the polite crowd of men you'll find on the golf course or at the bridge club, although that may be included here. He's talking about men, the public square, the world that we live in. When you acknowledge me before men, he acknowledges us before the Father in heaven. Christians, never more so than today, are called upon to acknowledge Christ before men. Having a little difficulty getting Ken Samples, we will have him a little later in the program today. We've moved up on our schedule Dr. Gene Edward Veith. He's culture editor of World Magazine. We're going to be talking about the anniversary that passed on Saturday, September 11th. 3 years ago was a day that probably changed world history and certainly changed American history. What has changed? How is the world different today from how it was 3 years ago on September 10th, 2001? Dr. Gene Edward Veith is a regular guest here on the program. He is culture editor of World Magazine, director of the Cronach Institute, a Lutheran voice in the public square, and author of the book Christianity in an Age of Terrorism. Dr. Veith, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be with you again.
If you had to put it in one sentence, what would you say has changed most in the last 3 years since September 11th?
Well, our complacency has been shattered. Our sense of security has been called into question. Now we're at war. And yet, we don't really know, I think, what to make of all of this because we're not really used to it. I guess for me, right after 9/11, I really did see some dramatic changes. I even did some writing about postmodernism, but now maybe postmodernism is over because here was a truth. You know, those planes crashing into the building that, you know, we didn't just construct for ourselves. And people were starting to face up to that. People were talking about evil. On 9/11, right and wrong seemed very clear. There wasn't a lot of question about evil being real and good being real, as we saw the heroism of those firefighters rushing up to the buildings to their deaths and the sacrifice of the passengers that brought down that plane against their hijackers and saved who knows how many others. But what strikes me 3 years later is that in many ways we haven't changed nearly as much as we should have. In fact, in many ways the old relativism is back. You know, people are questioning right and wrong. People are criticizing, the president and others. We're talking about these terrorists being evil. Now we're starting to, get the blame all twisted around, and we've lost our unity as a nation. We were very unified, as you can remember, in those weeks after 9/11 as a nation, and that was very different, and there was something good and refreshing and valuable about the way we came together as a nation, but now we're back at each other's throats.
We took a little vacation, as you mentioned, after September 11th from postmodernism,
yeah,
from moral relativism. My truth is as good as your truth, and our truths may actually be polar opposite, but we're both right, a kind of postmodernism. Does the staying power of postmodernism post-September 11th, Is that a testimony to its validity or to the truth of those relativistic ideas?
Well, it's a testimony to one of the symptoms of postmodernism, namely a short attention span. Our culture has trouble holding on to any kind of convictions or any kind of belief for very long. And so we see this in the polls. There seems to be political polls, and whatever anyone thinks, it changes so quickly. And however people are feeling, you know, on November 1st, you know, that will determine our political future for a while. And this is a symptom of postmodernism. You know, people blame, you know, the television for creating our short attention spans, our entertainment culture. We always have to be entertained, and we always need something new. And whatever the cause of it is, we're still very unstable as a society in our convictions. And after 9/11, you know, faded for a while, we went back to our old habits, or many people did.
One of the things that did occur immediately post September 11th was people, for a time, and it really, I think, if you look at the statistics, only lasted about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Three Sundays in a row,
yeah.
People were filling not only Christian churches, but synagogues and mosques and other houses of worship of well, in ways that were really astounding people who were measuring the numbers. They were saying, wow, maybe we're on the cusp of a genuine religious, if not Christian, revival. What became of those things?
Well, again, the old relativism came back, but in a way, it became almost worse, because the old relativism said, you know, you can believe anything that you want, and all religions are, you know, what your belief is your belief, and that's true for you, and I have my own beliefs, and everyone could have their own beliefs. Now, after 9/11, many people have the idea that the terrorists that we're fighting, what makes them so bad is not, you know, the content of their belief, you know, this belief that they're, you know, killing people for their God, but that it's that they have such strong religious beliefs. And so now, a lot of people, and we're hearing this a lot, Al Gore just talked about this in a speech just a couple of days ago, that any kind of belief, that of Christians, if you're really a conservative in your belief and really hold on to that, that's the same mentality as the terrorists, as the Taliban. And so a lot of people are saying, we need to be relativistic, that what we're up against is not, you know, militant Islam, but rather it's against fundamentalism, by which they mean anyone who holds strong moral and religious beliefs. So oddly enough, the very phenomenon of 9/11 has been spun in such a way as to make a lot of Americans, especially our cultural elite, suspicious of any kind of strong convictions. And so it's almost accelerated relativism.
That spin began almost immediately, mm-hmm. in the religious sector of our society, Dr. Veith.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking about the many interfaith gatherings that took place after September 11th, where if not the explicit message, at least the subtext of the gatherings was, we are going to show and demonstrate to the world that not only is Islam not a bad religion, we don't want Islam blamed, but we're going to demonstrate that all religions are essentially the same, and that what we really want to strive for is that so-called broad middle ground, that where all religions can agree, and that's how we're going to shape our religious discourse from now on.
Well,
and we'll avoid the extremes that brought about September 11th.
Yeah, and in fact, I think it's even more than that. You know, before 9/11, people were saying, or some people were saying, well, all religions are equally valid paths to God. But now it's almost as if you have to affirm all the different religions at once. In other words, it isn't just accepting your religion is equally valid, but let's worship together your religion and my religion. And it's almost become, I've said, a new polytheism. Okay? It's not just relativism, it's polytheism. And some people have been writing about this, saying that now we need to accept, not just tolerate other religions, not just see them as ways of salvation, but we need to bring together the world's religions into what's really a new religion that's different from any and all of them, a religion that has tenets of all these different beliefs so that we can accept them all as valid.
I've got a name for it, Dr. V. Actually, I got two names for it, for this religion that is the mixture of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
One's rather long and cumbersome. It's Isla Juda Buddha Hindianity.
Okay.
But the other one is much more simple to pronounce. It's September 11ism.
Mm.
It is the religion that emerged into the public square after September 11 that wasn't there before.
Yeah.
Its roots were there, but you mentioned it went beyond saying they're all equally valid paths to God to saying they are all essentially the same path.
Yeah, exactly, and you know, there's the whole issue of the civil religion. Now, that's always been a problem for Christians in a way that you know, these at our public gatherings, how we have, you know, begin with prayer and so on, and in the rhetoric of our presidents, all through the beginning, there's mention of God and so on, and God we trust. Now, I myself think that is a valid expression of the two kingdoms theology, that God is Lord over the nations. Also, that's not a saving knowledge. People don't know God apart from Jesus Christ, and we mustn't confuse the God's earthly reign with the spiritual revelation that he gives us in the church. But usually that civil religion had been monotheistic, and it was based on mostly the common religion that has formed this country, namely Christianity. But now there's and again there have always been problems with that too, and have to be very careful with it. But now there's a new civil religion. These days, even in small towns, if they have their 4th of July observances, they're likely not to just have a local minister give a prayer, but to bring on the platform Christians and Jews, and if they're lucky enough to have a mosque in the area, they'll bring him, so that they'll bring the imam of the mosque, so they're inclusive. And it really is a very profound shift in our nation towards a kind of a polytheistic understanding of what religion is supposed to be.
Let's talk more about that on the other side of the break. Dr. Gene Edward Veith is our guest. We're talking about the anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. Dr. Veith is author of the book Christianity in an Age of Terrorism. You can order it by calling 1-800-325-3040. We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Does God's law motivate the Christian to do good works? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. The next edition of the Issues, Etc. journal contains an article titled Getting Clear on Sanctification. It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest Dr. Stephen Hine. You can receive a complimentary copy of the next Issues, Etc. journal by calling our resource line 1-800-737-0172. Plus, I've written an article titled The Fad-Driven Church. Why are so many pastors worshiping at the altar of novelty? Find out with the Issues, Etc. journal, 1-800-737-0172. The next issue also details Uwe Simonetto's journey from hedonism to Lutheranism, 1-800-737-0172. Now, if you enjoy Issues, Etc., the radio program, you need to get the Issues, Etc. journal. Call now, 1-800-737-0172, and ask for a complimentary copy of the Issues, Etc. journal.
This is Family News.
Thank you.
on the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. We'll be talking with Brian O'Brien, spokesperson for Cruise Lines International Association, which represents the entire North American cruise industry. We'll also talk about a spark that ignites Brazil, an article in the Lutheran Witness magazine penned by Barbara Almstadt. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee, on AM 850 KFUO.
The book is titled Order Restored, A Biblical Interpretation of Health, Medicine, and Healing, and it's our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. The cost is $20.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Do modern-day faith healers have a biblical understanding of faith and healing? Find out with Order Restored. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section.
While abortion advocates turn a cold shoulder, the pro-life movement is reaching out to women suffering mental scars from their abortions.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Thousands of women suffer from anxiety, depression, and other mental ills as a result of their abortions. While abortion advocates coldly deny the reality of what these women suffer from, the pro-life movement reaches out to help them. The Susan B. Anthony List salutes Project Rachel and other programs all over the country which offer post-aborted women the comfort and healing they so desperately need.
The Susan B. Anthony List is dedicated to supporting pro-life legislation, training candidates and activists, and promoting pro-life leaders. To view all this month's commentaries, visit our website at sba-list.org. That's sba-list.org.
Recently, you might have missed all or part of one of your favorite programs here on AM 850 KFUO. That's why we have the KFUO website, www.kfuo.org. Visit our website, find archived audio, and listen to the entire program you missed. At our website, you can also contact our staff, donate online, and find program schedules. Our website is there for you, www.kfuo.org.
Well, some weeks ago, we began a study of the Pauline epistles, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, and Colossians. And that study will conclude with a final section, Colossians 4, next time on our Bible study program. Pastor John Lukowski will wrap it up for us next time on the Bible study. The Bible study, heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're marking the anniversary of September 11th and the terrorist attacks with Dr. Gene Edward Veith during this program. He's culture editor of World Magazine. You can read Dr. Veith's columns on the web at worldmag.com. Just look at the culture section. You have to scroll down just a little bit and click on culture, usually under that heading. You'll find something by Dr. Gene Edward Veith, worldmag.com. Now, I'd like to hear from you. They say that those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. September 11th is very recent history. Have we forgotten it already, or have we failed to learn the lessons that any decent, right-minded society should have learned from such an attack? We'll be talking about that with Dr. Veith, and I'd like to hear from you as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The best callers will receive Dr. Veith's book called Christianity in an Age of Terrorism, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Veith, we were talking about the religious pluralism that has emerged into the public square. Has it found its way into the churches too?
Well, it has, and I mean, our church went through a big controversy about it, and I don't want to condemn anybody, and I think sometimes Christian, for the best of motives, not realizing the stakes, sometimes, you know, get into things. But we need to understand kind of the big picture. You know, what this is saying of our culture and the place of Christianity in a society where now other religions, other gods are competing with us, and a new religion is forming that's really closer to the religion of the ancient Romans than it is to anything we've experienced. And I think some of us are kind of naive about that. This has been a problem, though, that's not new, and it wasn't created just by the terrorists. Back in the biblical days, in the times of the early church, the Rome was totally willing to accept Christianity as long as it took its place in the pantheon along with the other gods, just as they had all of the other the religions of all the other peoples that Rome had conquered. And of course, it was an issue in the Old Testament when even the Jews in the ancient time were tempted to also worship the gods of their neighbors, the Canaanite gods, to the point they even brought idols of other gods into the temple. And of course, God had a terrible judgment for that, and that was what brought to the Babylonian captivity and the exile. So this is a perennial issue for Christians, and it's probably healthy that this has been raised now so that we can think through some of these issues and try to figure out how we are to live in these times in a faithful way.
The prospect of terrorism, of course, was always there, but it has come to the fore of our consciousness in a way since September 11th that it simply could not have, I think, before the attacks in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania. Very recently, President George W. Bush was quoted as saying he didn't think we could win the war on terrorism. He was given an opportunity to clarify, and he said, look, it's just not going away. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a long fight against an intractable enemy. That's depressing, Dr. Veith, in a fast food culture that likes to have everything wrapped up in 22 minutes of sitcom time.
Well, it really is. And, I mean, part of the impact is that there have been people, I mean, the people of Israel have faced the danger of terrorism for decades and decades and decades, and they've learned to live with it, sort of, if you can. But we have been so prosperous, so sheltered in many ways, that when we learn that there are people who want to kill us and they don't care about any human feelings or anything. To me, the recent attack in Russia on the school children, that was traumatic, really, too. And their hearts have to go out to the people of Russia, our old adversaries, who are facing just this kind of evil that we just cannot even comprehend and get our minds around. And yet, in a way, I think our complacency, our security, made us too insulated from reality, that we didn't think about the shortness of life. We didn't always think about what's really important in life. We didn't even appreciate our own freedoms and the fact that they have to be defended sometimes. So after 9/11, for all the problems that are there, they're still there. It at least has shaken us up, and that can be a healthy thing in the long run.
Has it returned us, in at least in some way, to the mentality that prevailed for the better part of 50 years during the Cold War, where we had this long-term view that there's communism, it ain't going away, and if we're smart and prudent, we had better attend to it and not take our eye off the objective?
Yeah, that's a really good comparison. Again, it's very different because we had a nation that we were enemies to. We knew where they were. We had missiles pointed at each other. But you're right. We lived in that tension of this big ideological global struggle. And we still, what we're up against now is an ideological global struggle. Some people are calling it World War IV. Again, World War I, World War II, we know about World War III, they say, was the Cold War against communism that broke out in conflicts around the world, Vietnam, Korea, all these others, even though the two big nations didn't come to nuclear blows. But this is another kind of war, and it's not just a war about people who are wanting to kill us, there are ideas behind it. And the ideas of radical Islam, that is a very powerful worldview that's really opposed Western Christian civilization, just from the beginning all the way through the Middle Ages, almost as soon as Islam came into existence. And we're up against this now, and there is a difference in religions. There's a difference in the content of the different religions. And if we look at this properly, it should make us realize the radical differences between Islam and Christianity, namely a religion based on law only, that in its perverse way, for all of its moralism and legalism, can get people to do some very horrible things, versus the religion that's based on the gospel, on salvation by free forgiveness, that in turn allows freedom in every other part of our lives. And if we can use this to kind of see the differences more, that will be to our advantage.
You have written about fascism, and in particular, the new face of fascism. There are many faces, but the new face of fascism in its Islamic form, Islamofascism, has it strangely found an ally with the Western postmodern way of thinking, Islamofascism and postmodernism?
Well, I think it has, and I think that's one reason why at the universities and among our intellectuals, there's such sympathy for the terrorist. And again, you really can't put it in any other way. And I'd argue that a lot of the postmodern thinking, you know, grows, actually historically can be traced back to some of the fascist ideas. And many of the terrorists themselves have gone to Western universities, where they find their tendency just reinforced and encouraged, and their hatred for the West and for what they see as the imperialism of the decadence of the West is just heightened by their living in the West and by their going to school in the West and hearing the West's own ideas about itself, at least from the left-wing intellectual establishment. And so that feeds it. So I do think there's a strange paradoxical coming together of things that you would think would be very, very different. And again, a lot of Western intellectuals who are very permissive about homosexuality and are very committed to feminism and all these other things, it's very odd to hear them defend societies and a religion and an ideology that stones homosexuals to death, that puts the harshest restrictions on women, and yet they're advocating those same ideas out of their kind of confused postmodernist hatred for, I think, really the Christian foundation of Western civilization.
You mentioned before the Russian terrorist attacks that took place last week and the week before in that school. It's just an appalling story, an unbelievably appalling story in every respect. But even it would have been more appalling had it happened apart from the context of September 11th, because perhaps we've become desensitized. We've had Florida bashed by three hurricanes, and we yawn because, we're going to have to top September 11th now to get bigger headlines on something like that. Have we become callous to the real suffering of people around us because September 11th was such a big and a big tragedy and an attack pointed at us?
Well, I don't know. That's a really good question. It may well be, although, again, it's mainly a matter of perception. We haven't been attacked on this to the same magnitude that we had been in 3 years ago, and I think that's a testimony to our law enforcement people and our military people working behind the scenes in ways that we probably won't ever know about. If something else happens, we'll see just how traumatic it is. We'll see if that kind of gets us back into that kind of clarity of purpose that we had in those first days. Maybe it will, and yet, again, it might not, because we've now processed it so that we have become callous. It's just something that I hope we don't have to face.
When we try and take all of this together as a whole, if that can even be done, Dr. V, what would you say of, let's just talk about America. What would you say of America after September 11th that you couldn't say of America before September 11th? Good and bad.
Well, we've become a nation at war. We really are at war. We've conquered two different countries in a kind of amazing display of military might, Afghanistan and Iraq, and we are continually to fight these terrorist elements. Before, we were in a state of peace, maybe as a peace people cry peace, where there is no peace, and we had fooled ourselves about being at peace. Now we're in a state of war, and I think that's what a lot of people can't handle and can't accept, and they want to go back to peace, and some will do anything for peace, it seems like. But it was a war that we did not choose. It was brought upon us, and now we're living with the insecurities and the stress and strain and guilt that goes along with war. And right where we are now, I think it's a matter of how we come to terms with that.
Do we understand Islam as a religion and as a real political force in a better part of the world, I mean in a bigger part of the world than ever, do we understand it better?
Oh, no, not at all. Again, I think some people do, and some people are starting to. But as a whole, I think we live in denial. We see the terrorist attacks and these other things as just a function of bad people, perhaps, or of insane people. That term is used a lot to help us understand that people are just insane. But we don't see how it's driven by a worldview. It's driven by a faith. And it's one that holds things that we take for granted as being good, including our freedom that we have in society. They see that as a bad thing. And we project our good qualities that we have or think we have on other people. And again, that's a charming trait of the American character. And yet I think it sometimes gets us into trouble. And frankly, with the war in Iraq, you know, we assume that the Iraqis want to be free like we are, that they would love democracy. And maybe they do. Maybe deep down inside they do. Maybe they can be taught to value that. And yet there are things in their religion that are incompatible with that kind of life. And it's going to be harder than we think to change that underlying way of thinking that has borne fruit in the things that we're seeing. So I think there's a lot of naivete that we have, and sometimes that can bring us to good ideals, and it can create good things. We think the best of others, and that's a noble thing to feel. And yet I worry that we aren't looking the matter straight in the face.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. In about 15 minutes, we're going to conclude our series with Ken Samples on answering the objections of unbelievers. We're talking about the anniversary of September 11th and its aftermath with Dr. Jean Edward Veith during this hour. He is director of the Cranach Institute, a Lutheran voice in the public square. You can check out the website for the Cranach Institute by going first to our website, issuesetc.org. Look under the links with regular guests link, and you'll find a direct link to Dr. Jean Edward Veith and the Cranach Institute, issuesetc.org. What should we have learned? If you could, I mean, we are very proximate to this thing, so I'm not going to ask too much of you here, but what should we have learned as a culture and as a society from September 11th that you think we haven't learned?
Well, again, it is very close to the time, and the after effects are still being felt, and it's not clear exactly what's going to happen or which direction we're going. But I would say what we should have learned is that truth is objective and it's real and it's not under our control. It's not something we make up for ourselves. It's something objective and hard and cold, and it's something that we have to deal with. Also, morality is real. There really is good and evil, right and wrong. And we're part of a cosmic conflict between good and evil, right and wrong. And yet it's one where the evil is not just out there, and this is important for us to know, it's also inside us. And if we just think that it's outside, then we're missing where it really is and where it needs, where we need to deal with it. We need to realize that religions are not all the same, that religions are very different. Actually, we might say that all religions are very much the same, except Christianity. The other religions are religions of law, of legalism. And because of that legalism, they can sometimes be very, very cruel and very, very horrible, even when that's not the intention of a lot of their theologians and those who practice it. But it can breed that kind of cruelty. And Christianity can too. When Christianity gets legalistic, and it too can be cruel and sponsor terrorism and sponsor holy wars, as happened with the Crusades, and that's something that Luther opposed very much. But we need to look at the differences and to understand just how radically different the Christian faith is, and to not give in to the temptation to sell out that religion that gives us not only our political freedom, but it gives us spiritual freedom and everlasting life.
We recently talked with the author of a book called Why the Rest Hates the West, and he said that when the rest of the world, and in particular the Islamic world, hears Americans opine about freedom, they hear license. Mm-hmm. Because they have watched our cultural affluent, what we export as far as culture goes, corrupt the world. Has the culture gotten on a better track since September 11th?
Well, again, it's very interesting. For a few days, television stopped all of their violent and sexual bad programming, and even the studio network were talking about wanting to clean up their acts. Now, some see, and this may have a completely different reason, that there are more, that there are fewer R-rated movies being made and more family fare being produced. So the main reason is that they found that they can make a lot more money with family fare than with R-rated films. But I think that's part of the failure to morally face up to what's happened. Not that we are responsible for what these people, these terrorists, have done to us. We mustn't we don't want to blame the victim, even when we've been the victim. But it's true that our freedom has degenerated into license, that the things we export into the world give evidence when people consider us to be the great Satan. And so, again, that's part of the soul searching that we should be be engaged in to straighten out our own country, you know, even as we're trying to defend it. In other words, it's not just a matter of defending our way of life as it has become, but it's defending our best identity and getting back to our best identity when we're faced with an enemy that wants to destroy us. We need that reform. We need to reform ourselves even as we defend ourselves.
With only a minute here, Dr. Veith, has the Christian Church rightly seized the opportunity presented by the tragic attacks of September 11?
Well, I don't know, and I think some have, some haven't. There's some great examples of ministry, and there's a reason why people flood into their churches in time of great need. And the reason that I think they stopped doing that is that we have stopped seeing our great need and have started to be dependent on ourselves now. But I think that the churches should do a better job of being clear with what they believe, clear in our proclamation of what we believe, proclamation of how we need to live, and the proclamation of how we need to be salt and light in a very challenging and dangerous world.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith, thank you very much for being our guest, as usual.
Well, my pleasure.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith is culture editor of World Magazine, director of the Cronach Institute, a Lutheran voice in the public square, and he's also author of this book. It's a great book. It came out very shortly after September 11th. I think it is, although proven itself in its timeless quality, called Christianity in an Age of Terrorism. The book is $9.99, and you can order it from Concordia Publishing House by calling them toll-free, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the book, Christianity in an Age of Terrorism, by Dr. Gene Edward Veith, 1-800-325-3040. You can also find out more about this book at www.cph.org. That's the website for Concordia Publishing House, www.cph.org. On the other side of this break, we begin an hour-long conversation with Ken Samples, president of the Augustan Fellowship Study Center and author of the book, Without a Doubt, Answering the 20 Toughest Faith Questions. We're going to conclude our three-part series with Ken on answering the objections of unbelievers. Today, we're going to think through some specific objections, and I invite you, if you have an objection or if you've heard one that we don't deal with, to join us at 1-800-730-2727. That conversation with Ken Samples right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.